Appreciate the opportunity to present to you today to the court. Doug Whitland with Butcher and Whitland, representing the Atone 5200 LLC, which is Barry Hirschfeld, who in fact is in the courtroom today with us. This is a case like the last one where it's interesting that you have to look at the consequences that a overturning this case would provide in the future in the eminent domain bar, especially in this area of substantial impairment of access. Now, the substantial impairment of access is where a landowner's means of access to his property, if they're substantially impaired or destroyed, you're entitled to damages under the Colorado Constitution. That's Article 2, Section 15, where that states that private property can't be taken or damaged without, for public use, without payment of just compensation. In this case,
if I can interrupt you, I'm going to step right at issue here. I guess I need your help on what your definition of substantially impaired is. In Davis, the Supreme Court said you have to compensate for substantial impairment, but it said it's not substantially impaired. In that case, it happened to be you had to take a more circuitous route. They lost the main access, had to take a circuitous route. Here, for 20 years, this building was serviced by trucks and no rail. Why is there substantial impairment when all the same services, the trucks can pull up just like they have for 20 years? Where's the substantial impairment here when you have the same opportunity? You're just basically saying, I have to use a different means. But you got the same access to the truck route. You don't have any guarantee that Union Pacific would provide this service anymore. Where's the substantial impairment in this case?
Well, first, Your Honor, you're asking for a definition of substantial impairment of access and what that precise definition would be. It's like pornography. The Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court found, you know it when you see it. You can't define it up front. It has to be a fact-based, specific inquiry based on highest and best use. Because if you look at this property that we're looking at, the subject property, 10-acre site with industrial buildings on it, you had the rail coming off Smith Road around the back of the property to the south, the rail line actually coming, to the bottom of the aerial, and then 5200 owning in fee a tail out to that rail line that was active as of the date of value. So,
how do you say it was active at the date of value?
Your Honor, the line from Smith Road coming across Smith, around and through and behind the subject property was an active rail.
Oh, okay. The spur just into the property backed up. That was not active. In fact, was paved over, as I recall.
Well, portions of it was. It was paved over, but it was owned in fee by 5200, and it goes into a U-shaped docking area that actually this whole area was configured to take advantage of rail. Now, the reason rail wasn't used for quite some time at the property was that there's a printing press business, National Hirschfeld, that actually was declining when you saw the internet use come up. So we had paper product printing going down. Also, National Hirschfeld really didn't make a conscious decision not to use the rail. Rather, there was a single supplier of paper that decided they were going to truck. So it wasn't a conscious decision on behalf of National Hirschfeld to discontinue use of rail because it was obsolete, but rather that supplier deciding they weren't going to use rail.
Is there any evidence in this record that Union Pacific would provide rail if you just decided, we want to go back to rail?
Sure. Union Pacific actually hired an expert in this case, William Brunskill, that opined in his report that rail could be restored to this.
That wasn't my question. I understand. You could restore anything.
Sure.
That's fine.
Sure.
I accept that. Is there any evidence Union Pacific would have done so when they have now all these, I forgot, intermodal depots or whatever they're called?
Mr. Brunskill's testimony was that UP would have continued service to this neighborhood. In fact, it was continuing service, and but for the project, they would have continued service.
When you say service, and I'm sorry to keep interrupting, I'm just trying to understand. When you say continued service, are we talking through intermodal means or through rail means to the door?
Rail means directly to the door. There's other properties in this immediate neighborhood that were served directly to the door. One's KIK Enterprises. KIK was one where RTD actually relocated them because they had a need for rail that couldn't be served by any other intermodal facility or other method of delivery. So they had to have the rail. So, yeah, there was testimony from Mr. Brunskill, that's RTD's own expert, that said, hey, you would have had rail service directly to this building before the project.
Pardon me, Council, how many businesses are along this rail curve that also services the Hirschfeld property?
Oh boy, I'd be speculating, but probably in the area of 10.
How many are served today by the train?
I believe the train's now cut off by virtue of the project.
How many were served by the train before it was cut?
I would say in the neighborhood of 10 properties.
10 were served. Where are their cases?
Well, they're not here today. And those properties actually, for the most part, are located back behind Smith Road. This case, the rail issue came up because the takings along Smith Road, the cessation or severance of the rail line was actually at Smith Road off-site. And, of course, an issue in this case, substantial impairment, doesn't involve a question whether the severance of the impairment was on or off-site. But this is where it was severed because the commuter rail to DIA is actually going to run here and you can't cross it with these freight trains. So back in here, several properties, as you can see, the rail extended south here, extends west along here, and several of these properties have frontage or sidings on the track. This is Alpine Lumber. He used a siding that was right here on the south side of their building.
When was that last used?
That one, I think they ended their contract in 2011.
Yes, I keep interrupting, Mr. Whitland. I apologize. I thought you were talking about a UP expert, and then you're talking about an RTD expert. Mr. Brunskill, which one is Mr. Brunskill?
Mr. Brunskill is an RTD expert, formerly a UP employee, in my knowledge.
All right, so he specifically testified that UP, I mean, I guess, does he have standing to say what UP would do? That's sort of getting back to my question. Did UP say it would provide this rail at the
We certainly do not have any direct testimony from Union Pacific. All we have is the experts opining to highest and best use and what are probabilities in this case versus possibilities. And Mr. Brunskill did testify it was probable that rail could be restored and service would have continued at least into the near future by Union Pacific but for this project.
Now, would you agree that your client didn't have a right to have UP provide the service, true?
Well, I don't think I agree with that. I think even private parties have the right to contract without interference from the government. And I think this is a situation where RTD would have you find that, in fact, there's no problem with interfering with private party contracts.
But it would depend if UP agreed. Right.
Obviously, in this case, the evidence is that UP had no intention to cease service. In fact, RTD paid Union Pacific to cease service and to have their property and to cut the line to this neighborhood and other neighborhoods. But this one's interesting from the standpoint, you have to look, what are the ramifications if this court demands to the trial court? If you look at the trial court's order, all the trial court did was find that rail is not the means of access to this property. It didn't say you can't have substantial impairment in the instances of rail. It didn't make that finding. What it said was, today, the data value, rail is not the means of access. You have to look at highest and best use, not just the current use. And that's where the court erred. So I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal funding.
My name is Joel Spector. Attorney registration number 36561, and I represent Regional Transportation District. May it please the court. This is a case in which RTD is acquiring less than 1% of 5200's 10-acre subject property. Separate and apart from that acquisition, RTD is also acquiring a small sliver of land from Union Pacific Railroad. Now that's off the subject property. And in doing so, 5200 RTD will effectively sever what's left of a former rail spur that used to lead directly to 5200 subject property. And I say what's left of it because the reality is since the mid-1990s, 5200 hasn't been using the rail. The rail switch has been removed, and the driveway rail spur leading directly to 5200's property has been effectively paved over.
Pardon me, Mr. Spector. Would you agree with 5200 that there's active rail delivery along that line to other customers besides 5200?
I don't think there's any evidence in the record that supports what it is today or what it has been. My understanding was that there are fewer than 10 properties served by, there were fewer than 10 properties served by that, maybe three or four. But I think that gets to an interesting point, and that is, if this case, counsel for 5200 started out by saying that this court has to consider consequences of this case. The consequences of this case are that if 5200 has a claim of substantial impairment of access, then effectively every property owner, industrial property owner south of Smith Road, would have a similar inverse condemnation action based on the same substantial impairment of access. They too won't be able to, they might be able to build rail, just like 5200 might be able to reinstall rail. The reality is, they wouldn't have a right to the rail. They would still have an inverse condemnation claim because they wouldn't be able to access the rail.
Well, I guess I'm not understanding your point, Mr. Spector. You know, it may well be that 10 people have a claim for inverse condemnation if they have can prove substantial impairment. So what? I mean, isn't that just a matter of proof? I mean, what difference does it make if it's 10 or 1,000 people have a claim? I mean, I recognize you've got to make the satisfy the requirements, but I guess I don't understand the point you're making.
I guess my point is this isn't necessarily a legal basis. It's counsel for 5200 stood up here and said that the court has to consider consequences. That's just one of the consequences, is that it will open up the door, not just 4 or 10, but anybody south of Smith Road, who the rail line is going to be, RTD line is going to be going parallel to Smith Road, and anybody south of Smith Road will have a similar inverse condemnation claim based on substantial impairment of access.
Or they were in somewhat close proximity to a railroad spur.
Maybe, maybe not. I mean, if you could argue that your property's located a mile south of Smith Road, and that you had the right to, you wanted to build a rail spur off the main line, you could argue that you're no longer able to do that because access is substantially impaired.
Well, doesn't that talk about what's the factual state of the record? There's a difference between a record that says that there are UP trains that go along this curve off across Smith Road and around to the south and service other businesses every day. If that is the state of the record, then the property owner might have some basis to say, hey, if I sell this to some other business, this may be important. They come in, they see it, they see these trains come by, they say, this is the way that I want to have my business stop. On the other hand, if there are no trains going by and no one else is using it, doesn't that factually create a different scenario?
I don't think it does. Because in a condemnation action, our landowner is only entitled to compensation based on unique characteristics of that property, something different than everybody else experiences, different than the general population experiences. And that's why the law in Colorado limits damages in an eminent domain action to what takes place on the subject property, not something that takes place off the subject property.
Well, why should that be the case? I mean, take the Bayview Associates case that 5200 cited. I think it was a New Jersey case, if I remember. That was an off-site issue. Now, I recognize there may be a distinction because in that case, the evidence was that they were using that rail spur daily, and the evidence was the trains would keep coming, but for the impairment. Why should that not be the rule? If you can prove substantial impairment, whether you know the taking happened off-site but directly impacted, it's a causation issue, directly impacted that landowner's property. That's the Bayview Associates case. Mr. Whitlam says that's his case too, and you can debate that. But I'm not sure I'm understanding why the rule should be if the taking happens 5 feet off-site and directly impacts this landowner, that makes a difference.
Well, I'd say there are two reasons for that. First, the law in Colorado is that you're only entitled to damages based on what happens on the subject property, not what happens off the subject property. Now, there's a separate jurisprudence about damage to property based on Colorado Constitution. But in Colorado, under Colorado law, you're only entitled to damages based on what takes damages that result to the remainder of the property based on what takes place on the subject property.
Well, what is that? I mean, maybe I need some help on the law, because my understanding of Davis was that you have to compensate for loss of access if there's a substantial interference. You know, factually, it may well be that that taking happened on the property, but I'm not sure Davis necessarily restricted it to that. So what's the basis for the legal argument you're making that it has to be taken on the property?
Well, even the Colorado jury instructions make that, it's black letter law in Colorado. And in opposing counsel's brief, they state it as the general rule in Colorado. And in fact, that's what they're
saying. With an exception. You're leaving
right.
out the exception.
Exactly. Okay. The exception is substantial impairment of access cases. And that's why they tried to take this case out of the normal eminent domain jurisprudence and shoehorn this case into a substantial impairment of access case.
Can we agree then, just making sure I'm understanding, that you can have an issue of substantial impairment if the taking was offsite?
I mean, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yes. Right. In this case, however, there's two important reasons why 5200's arguments can't prevail. The first, I want to just briefly mention each of them, and then I'll discuss them each in more detail. The first reason is, in Colorado, legal access is provided by the public street system, not private rail. And there's no dispute over the fact that 5200 will retain access to the general public street system. And the second reason is that even assuming, arguendo, that private rail could somehow constitute legal access in Colorado, 5200's access to rail is not being substantially impaired because, as we've discussed, 5200 will retain access to the modern intermodal rail facilities, three of which are located within 5 miles of the subject property. I want to discuss both of those in a little more detail. In Colorado, the Constitution, statutes, and case law all provide that legal access is provided by the public street system, not private rail. And we've heard that there's good reason for that distinction.
Have we ever made that distinction in the case law? Has a Colorado case ever said, rail does not constitute part of the legal access formula?
No Colorado court has had opportunity to expressly make that distinction. But the Colorado Constitution, statutes, and case law all lead to the conclusion that all provide that legal access is provided by the public street system, not private rail. And there's a good reason for that distinction. Colorado courts have recognized that without access to the general public street system, a property is effectively worthless. The same is not true for private rail. In fact, 5200's own expert testified that without direct access to rail directly to the 5200 property, the property will still be worth $4.1 million. Now, in 5200's opening brief, they didn't mention this public-private distinction. In 52's reply brief, they never mentioned this public-private distinction. And opposing counsel stood up here a few minutes ago, and never did he mention how he somehow has a right to use private rail. The best that he said in answer to your question, Judge Gabriel, is that Union Pacific would have to agree in a contract to provide that right. Let me put it another way. 5200 doesn't have a right to use private rail unless they contract, and Union Pacific has to agree to that contract.
Can you briefly address, Mr. Spector, I know you want to get to your other point, but what was the evidence relating to UP? I was asking Mr. Woodland about that. What's your view on what the evidence was as to whether UP would provide this service or not?
It's speculative as to whether UP would have provided the service, but most importantly, 5200's own expert admitted that they couldn't force Union Pacific to send a rail car directly to 5200's property. So at any time, Union Pacific could have decided not to do that. And in fact, as we know, 5200 has not been sending rails down that former rail spur since the mid-1990s.
So isn't this really a causation issue as opposed to one where we have to draw a line between private and public? I mean, isn't that really what you're arguing, that there's no evidence of causation in this case? My question is whether we have to draw this private-public distinction, or whether if we agreed with you, we could make a more limited ruling to say there's just no causation here, evidence of causation.
I think you could rationalize it that way, but I think the public-private distinction is one that's really important, in that the Maryland Hickey case, Colorado Supreme Court, said that if you don't have a right to the access, then you can't be deprived, substantially deprived of access if you never had a right to the access to begin with. So in this case, the Sinclair Marketing case said that a private rail should not be confused with a public right of way. Sinclair Marketing case made that express distinction. So if you don't have a right to access somebody else's private rail, you can't be substantially deprived of that access.
Who had the burden of proof here to establish substantial impairment?
5200 had the burden of proof.
Would part of that proof be establishing that Union Pacific would contract with them to provide the rail?
That possibly. That would certainly get them closer. But there is no evidence in the record that 5200 would, Union Pacific would guarantee to have contracted to provide rail service into the future indefinitely. Let me just briefly touch on the second point. 5200 will retain access to the general public street system, and they will retain access to a modern intermodal rail facility. Now, it's important to understand specifically what 5200 is asking for in this case. They're not just asking for this court to find that there's a right over private rail. They're also asking for this court to find that there's a right to access over private rail directly to the subject property. Because, like I said, they will have access to the modern intermodal rail facilities. If this 5200 is argued in their reply brief that they can't be forced to accept some sort of replacement substitute, and they cited a case dealing with an irrigation ditch. And it's true that generally speaking, a condemning authority couldn't take an irrigation ditch, build it somewhere else, and force the landowner to accept that as a replacement. That's understood. That's not what's at issue here. 5200 has made this a substantial impairment of access case. And as Your Honor noted earlier, under substantial impairment of access jurisprudence, it's different than normal eminent domain jurisprudence in that you're not entitled to the best, most convenient access. You're only entitled to some reasonable access. And in this case, the modern intermodal rail facility would provide that reasonable access. And that, again, assumes arguendo that private rail could somehow constitute legal access in Colorado. The district court in this case excluded the evidence because 5200 argued it didn't adequately consider their highest and best use evidence. The reality is the district court had this highest and best use evidence in front of it when it excluded the evidence. We would ask this court to affirm the district court decision. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Whitland, you've got a few seconds, over 6 minutes.
Thank you. In response to RTD's argument, Mr. Spector, regarding the evidence of continued rail access, RTD's own expert, Mr. Brunskill, in response to questioning on page 497 of the record, states, the question was, okay, so absent the RTD project, did you perceive those customers still receiving service from Union Pacific, at least into the foreseeable future, which may or may not be too long, 4 or 5 year period at least? Answer, that would be logical, yes, sir. So their own expert determined that, in fact, rail would be still available to these customers in the foreseeable future, including the 5200 project.
Was there any testimony in the record that this line had fallen into, I think the word was obsolescence?
Oh, I think there's no doubt it was. It was obsolete at the time of the date of value. But the key to these cases is, in every aspect evaluation, you have to look at highest and best use. You have to look at the probability of what the future use of this property could be put to, not speculating as to damages, not speculating as to use, but to what probably could happen with this property in the future. That's Civil Jury Instruction 4th Edition, Eminent Domain 36-6, which says you have to look at these probable future uses. This trial court looked only at the current use. It's vacant. There was no user to this building. Rail wasn't being used. That's not the highest and best use. You can't make this determination of impairment without looking at highest and best use.
Could you address, Mr. Woodland, the last point Mr. Spector made, which is that your client is not entitled to the best, most convenient access when you're looking at substantial impairment? What's your response to that?
Well, I don't think that's the rule. I think that you have to look at, just like the court said in, Supreme Court said in Department of Highways versus First Interstate Denver West, you can't fashion an exact rule as to what constitutes substantial impairment. Does complete destruction of a means of access amount to substantial impairment? Maybe, but maybe you have some other means of access like here that would be sufficient. But in this case, we have a means of access that's completely destroyed. Now, this building is specifically situated and constructed to take advantage of rail. So what we're trying to do in these condemnation cases is replicate the marketplace. What would a buyer and seller look at in this case and say, hey, this property has the ability to access rail. That's a property, the piece of this property that's valuable in the market. So do I have that ability to access rail or I don't?
But was there evidence that the value is different if you have the equal ability to access a truck coming from the intermodal facility less than 5 miles away?
5200's appraiser had paired sales that he looked at. And we looked at both land sales, we looked at comparable improved sales, and rental rates. So you cover the income approach and the market approach on how rail access, rail availability affects market value.
And they compared to sites that had the trucking service from the rail or not?
Regular industrial sites with only vehicular access, correct. So back to Mr. Spector's two points. First, public roads only are entitled to substantial impairment of access. It's not the law in Colorado. It's just not the law. It's never been stated.
Where is your case then that will hold that basically a substantial impairment of private access, it needs to be compensated as well?
Nor is there a law that says private access is not part of this substantial impairment equation.
So there's no law either way?
No, there's no law either way.
So then what do you do with the Maryland Hickey case, which says if you don't have that case had to do with, I think, visibility from the road.
That's
so if you don't, and the court did say you don't have a right to it, so you can't prove substantial impairment.
Sure. Sure, and the Maryland Hickey case is interesting. I had a case right up next door where we got visibility damages. So that one's a little more public. The Maryland Hickey case is simply one of visibility, and visibility only, to the property from the traveling public. So you don't have contracts with the traveling public. You don't have any rights with the traveling public and to say, hey, you look at my property, look at Maryland Hickey Ministries. That's not the case here. We had a definitive way to get to rail, a fee tail coming out of the property that could access rail that the market would recognize and pay value for. And that's substantial impairment. That's Article 2, Section 15, allowing damages when you have a public use taking or severance like we do here. Second point Mr. Spector brought up was this intermodal access. Delayed case in Colorado, you don't, as a condemnee, have to accept substitute facilities. That's what RTD is asking you to find. That, hey, you can just go trucking off site somewhere to a rail facility, get your goods and truck it back.
What if the property has been using just that?
That's irrelevant to the question if the highest and best use of this property is to use the rail facilities, and that's the determination of 5200's appraiser.
Let me ask you this. If it had never had a spur, would we be here? Because you'd be saying, well, it could have had a spur.
Well, you don't know.
Well, I know. I'm asking you like I did the last case. Help me out here.
I'm out of time, but...
Yeah, you can still answer this question. I bet Jeff Bernard will give you permission.
I'm telling you, I would not be here.
I understand. I understand. But in a way, I guess what I'm wondering is, if the spur wasn't there, you wouldn't be here. There's a spur, but it's obsolete. What's the difference between building a spur and essentially rebuilding that spur?
There might not be any difference, but what you have to do is look at these probabilities. How do they stack up to get to highest and best use that's reasonably probable? If you have a ton of expenses, you have to cross public rights away, acquire private properties, go through PUC approvals, etc. To get to that level, the probability is probably not there. So this floodgate argument isn't legitimate because it's a fact-based inquiry each time. And it's not easy to be a landowner in condemnation cases, for sure. It's a tough proof. It's the burden on the landowner to prove. So as those probabilities stack up, like we have the rail in place. We have a connection to UP on an active line. We have a building specifically configured to take advantage of rail.
Thank you, Council. Thank you. You're out of time.
I could go on for a while.
We're sure you could. Council, thank you very much for your arguments today. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. Safe journey home.